Yeah, so this reminds me of some work I've been doing recently in vernacular music. For example, the vernacular music that comes from the African-American tradition is oftentimes focused on activity. So you have work songs that help to keep the time of certain activities that were done, on a cotton plantation or something like that. But they're also oftentimes embedded within those locations. They talk about things like the heat of the sun, the materiality of the cotton, the pain of experiencing the work, all of those kind of ambient additions to just the song itself as an artifact. What's really interesting about these is that they index not just the African American experiences in the prisons or on Jim Crow plantations, but also, as scholars like Amiri Baraka have noted, they index the experience of slave life itself and kind of go, I guess, so in other words, Cora, I think if we're to understand it correctly, we need to understand it both in terms of current place, but also place in time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, all the places that have built up to that moment. And what I would even say that you're more of the expert on those folk songs than I am, but I do know that the Lomaxes traveled around and brought their giant recording equipment with them to record sometimes onto aluminum, right? And so just the idea of how both the cultural situatedness of that idea of this white father and son theme traveling around to African American prisons, but also the materials they were bringing and the ways they were recording and how I would assume that anything you listen to now, you can hear echoes of that machinery that they use, those materials.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the really fascinating things about the sonic archive.
Sonic moments like that have that complex of a meaning. I think that's part of what Rickard is trying to draw our attention to with the whole notion of ambience, is that, hey, there are so many ambient things going on in any situation. It would be silly to assume that we can identify exactly the affordances of any single place, any single choric moment. And I think he really applies that to Kairos, too, in the next chapter, where he really has an issue with. Here's a quote from page 85. He doesn't like when contemporary theories of Kairos, quote, rely on an opportunistic frame, one that reinscribes it in a narrative of subjective control or advantage. And I think his issue with that that narrative of subjective control is that we assume that a moment comes to us and then we dive in and take advantage of it. When I think he would say that really Kairos needs to be understood almost, I don't know if this is too mysterious, but almost as if Kairos has its own sort of agency, as if the Kairos is something that is already there. And again, here's another quote that in some way, the Kairos does what it does to us, with us and alongside us. It's on page 90. And there's something related there to what you're saying, that to understand this, we have to understand the ways that it was kairotic beyond anyone's control.